Dove Creek, a novel read by the author Paula Coomer and brought to you by KRFP in Moscow, Idaho.
Mystery, mystery, behind the veil, surprise me. Confound me. Surround me.
This is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or used in a fictional way. Any resemblance to actual locales or persons, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.
Practicing psychologist tells Patricia a story about a girl and her dancing red shoes. Back on the Lost Dean, Patricia reads through old journals. In the midst of it, they hand you a stack of books and put you in front of a classroom full of fashion and reproductive biology conscious immature post-adolescents and tell you to teach yourself how to teach people to write. The situation pissed me off. How did folks get to college without knowing how to write? Snot-nosed, privileged kids of doctors and lawyers, and they don't know how to write? I learned to teach by inventing ways to keep occupied so I wouldn't spit and walk out of the class, which may explain why the job doesn't pay very much, which certainly explains why I'm here, reduced to the rubber-matted confines of a Greyhound bus rather than a plane, shooting through the Northern Rockies and Great Plains to my birthplace in Louisville, Kentucky. Then east by car along I-64 for 25 miles to Ramsey, Indiana, where Mom and Daddy now live. They moved 2 years ago to the 4 acres of yellow clay and scrub cedar we've owned since the 1960s, displaced earth and built a cement block tornado shelter and foundation, then installed a 28 by 64 modular home with cathedral ceilings and skylights, along with a series of decks. It is, my mother declares, the first place she's been able to get houseplants to bloom. It is also the place where last summer, Daddy insists he was bitten by a copperhead snake, even though an MRI shows he suffered a minor stroke. I think about how the visit will be, riding through an Idaho so far north that in the winter the sun sets at about the same time the school day ends. I think I live here because I need this dark time of year, time to read, to write, to watch movies, time to ponder the way of things, time to ponder the news my landlady brought this morning, a woman with whom I have shared tea and trouble for 5 years now, telling me she is leaving her husband, a man she has known, loved, and with whom she has lived for 44 years. In the 6 months since her mother died, Gail has dieted and walked away 40 pounds, revealing a small-boned schoolgirl frame, dyed and cut drab midlife hair into a retro 70s shag, begun wearing high heels and hoop earrings, and now, as she told me this morning, is divorcing her husband. I never really enjoyed his company, she said. I only stayed with him because my mother loved him so. She is becoming, she said, the woman she could not be in front of her mother. There are two women across the aisle from me. They look at home in the light of these meager reading lamps. From their conversation, I know they are both recently widowed and fill their days with travel. One is wearing a coat she bought in Scotland. It is taupe and appliqué in places with fabric that resembles a loopy Sherpa knit. She is 79, her companion 83. I wonder what I look like to them. A bit overfed, perhaps, or from their vantage points, trifocals perched above cellophane jawlines and necks. Maybe I appear young and firm. This natty 8-year-old black wool coat minus its buttons, artsy instead of forlorn. At our meal stop in Whitebird, having descended between basalt canyon walls along a whipping snap-to grade and the middle fork of the Salmon River, the two sit in a red booth across the diner from me. I want to walk up and ask, what is it like? How does it feel to no longer be anyone's wife, daughter, mother? Was it your first taste of freedom, the beginning or end of eternal heartache? I linger after finishing my coffee, thinking to walk over and address them for the sake of research, but am afraid of reigniting old grief, old dirt, with their destination still 4 hours away and plenty of time also to ponder. Miraculously, the younger one speaks as if in answer to my telepathy. When your loved one passes on, you have to rebuild your life. If not, living in grief, you're no good to yourself or anyone else. I stand and pay the tab for my coffee, walk from the melted Crisco smell of the diner to a sky dark as sleep, suck in winter air. The Bitterroot Mountains, imposing by day, have vanished, obstructed by the black blood of night. Two women in down coats and hiking boots lean on the log hitching post. "Look at what I bought us, Mom," the youngest of the two says, displaying a bag of multicolored gumdrops. "Well, and look at what I bought," the older woman replies, handing her an identical bag of the same candy. 10:12 p.m., Mountain Time Zone, Boise, Idaho. I have been in this bus terminal before. I was 20, and it was August of 1978, and I was on my way to Salem, Oregon, to meet up with Kevin the poet, leaving Mom and Daddy for good. The place looked more threatening then. Long-legged transients sporting crumpled paper grocery bags, greasy-haired exchange students traveling on Ameripasses with backpacks, candy bar wrappers and empty booze bottles on unwashed floors, bathrooms smelling of cigarettes, patchouli oil, and herbal essence shampoo, young women in there with bawling babies trying to apply another day's makeup across cruddy sinks. Tonight, a silver mop bucket is wheeled along by a black woman wearing heavy coats of russet rouge and lipstick and the uniform of Greyhound employees, gray trousers, light blue shirt. Security guards with clubs at each of the front and rear entrances, baggage handlers and cops roaming in and out, a dry-witted, silver-haired ticket agent behind the cage counter, and a cowboy exchanging glances over the anxieties of a young, trendy woman who looks to be the cowboy's girl. Memories of my mother are jaded by her breakdowns. We lived in a tiny Ohio River farming community called Lanesville, Indiana. It was a step up for both my parents. Our home was a tar-roofed basement which popped out of the ground at about chest height to my young body. I wasn't quite tall enough, even by the time I was 9 and we moved to town, to climb on top of it. But Daddy was, and forced to do so after every snowfall or rain to sweep the water away. It was that or zero in a bevy of Tupperware bowls and cooking kettles to catch it as it dripped through the ceiling. We had 62 acres, a cow, boarding hogs, a dog named Prince, plenty of chickens, and their micromanaging rooster, a pond, a large garden and fruit orchard, but no running water or indoor toilet facilities. Every morning and every evening, Daddy drove his black 64 Falcon across the bridge to Louisville and his job as a carpenter at a place called Empire Homes, a bridge Grandpa Darnell helped build as part of a prison work crew. One night when I was about 5, Daddy came home very late from work. He told Mom he'd given a neighbor woman a lift on the way home, had a flat tire. Mom said, "It doesn't take until 3 in the morning to fix a flat tire." I don't know why the woman happened to be in the same place Daddy was, although he did moonlight at the gas station my Uncle Gus managed. Perhaps she was moonlighting too. Either way, I can still see Mom sitting in her usual spot on a kitchen chair in the dust-moted sunlight. The tears went forever, dampening hanky after hanky. I awakened in the night some days later to the sound of the woman and her husband in our living room. Mom wiped her eyes with our best dish towel, her belly large and round, crimped between legs and breasts by her sunken position on the couch. The neighbor man with his black hair and farm boots sat on the rolled arm of it next to her, his wife on the matching armchair leaning forward with her hands together like Jesus on the cardboard fans at the Mount Zion Methodist. She was pretty, wearing a yellow shirt waist and tiny pierced earrings. I knew her because her mother was my good friend, Mrs. Beckham, who lived down the road and gave me cookies and Kool-Aid in colored aluminum glasses, which made my teeth ring. Mom told me to bring Kleenexes and to go lie back down on her bed. I always started out there until Daddy came home and made it my bed on the couch. I felt sorry for Mom and for that jack-in-the-box rolling around inside her that was maybe a new baby brother. Whatever happened, she never got over it, and still talks about how she had plenty of reason, according to the Bible, to get divorced, but stuck it out for the sake of us kids. My mother was born with the jet-black hair and tinted skin of her Cherokee grandparents. She has always been beautiful. In early pictures, her hair is bobbed and beauty-caught parlor chic, her repentant smile highlighted by Avon brick red or magenta. Thick eyeglasses sit on proud cheekbones, magnifying dark loam irises stricken with nystagmus. They jitter and twitch as if steeped in caffeine. In school, kids called her the girl with the dancing eyes. Mom also has deformed legs and feet. At 4'11", she suffers from congenital toeing in, or pigeon toe, with stubbed severe arches and genuvarum, or knock knees. Only specialty catalogs carry her shoe size, 5EEE. Still, at 19, her otherwise shapely torso and lipstick grin captured my red-haired father's attention. He loves to tell the story of the day he met her at his sister's apartment. She was a little bitty old thing. She had a chicken leg in one hand, a glass of milk in the other, and a milk mustache. Mom always follows with her own, "Yes, and we'd go to bed as soon as he came in and let the biscuits burn. Every night, the same thing." She sewed her own clothes and later matching dresses for me. Mostly by then from the patterned flour sacks her 25 pounds of flour came in. It seemed like a bargain to me. That flour made cookies, pie dough, and cakes. As a bonus, you got material with pink and green faded flowers or hazy gray line pictures of famous art. The fabric was soft, cottony, and I imagined myself to be the best-dressed girl at Mount Zion Methodist, where I was first baptized and where I once found a golden Easter egg with a dime taped to it. "You found the golden egg," my daddy said. But when my younger sister Dorinda came along, Mom stopped all that, ordering Easter dresses in triplets from the Aldens or Sears and Roebuck catalog, which, of course, doubled for toilet paper in the two-seater. Another memorable breakdown came when I was 14. Mom collapsed one Easter Sunday while singing in the State Street Baptist Church choir. I was wearing a dress I'd made myself, a gauzy white batiste with grass-green flowers lined with white, leaving sheer the Juliet sleeves, as was the fashion after the release of Franco Zeffirelli's film Romeo and Juliet. It had had a white grosgrain ribbon stationed rib-high, which tied in the back, and the remnants of which I'd laced through oversized gold eyelets on a pair of white patent leather baby doll shoes, purchased with wages from rolling soft-served vanilla ice cream cones and sundaes at the Zesto drive-in. After that day, every small event set her to crying. And when a stack of prefab walls fell on Daddy at work, even though he was treated at the ER and released, she had to be put to bed. We had moved into the town of New Albany by then, into a real house, an old farmhouse with running water and flowered wallpaper but no closets, and the ghost, I imagined, of its previous owner who died in the bed that came with the house, that great mahogany head and footboard which was relegated to me. Subsequently, we converted to the Pentecostal religion, Holy Ghost and fire, in part because I had made friends with a pair of classical musicians, because Mom was convinced she might find supernatural healing for her new fear of public places. Still, it was a decade before she stepped foot inside a restaurant or department store, although she faithfully attended church services thrice weekly. And a few times there were ambulances in the middle of the night. I didn't know it then, but Mom was alternating Librium and diet pills during the day to keep her 34-year-old body trim for Daddy, Librium at night to calm her nerves, and glass after glass of stove-brewed iced tea. My family has a secret story about the day my Aunt Callie found her Daddy, my mother's stepfather, in the milk barn with his pants down on top of my mother. Mom was 12, Callie 9. Callie held a pitchfork to his bare ass and said, "Get off of her or I'll kill you." I wonder how her voice echoed in the hollow rafters of that milk barn, in the hollows of those Kentucky hills. 10:41 p.m. My connection to Salt Lake City is due in at 12:15 a.m., but the ticket agent says the bus is an hour late. I cannot think of Salt Lake without thinking of Terry Tempest Williams' refuge. At least I still have both breasts, and my mother still has both her breasts. All the women in my family have both breasts, just the opposite of Terry's. 10:55 p.m. My mother's other symptom is hyper-religiosity. Everything outside of reading the Bible, watching evangelists on TV, or listening to gospel music constitutes sin. She has visions of the Shekinah glory light, speaks in tongues, and sometimes knows the future. Last year, my sister Dorinda, whose bedroom eyes and petite voluptuous body mimics that of our mother and earns her living, even at 42 as an exotic dancer, began examining her life, trying to decide why she still works at a young woman's job, one that appeals to the emotionless of our culture, why she uses alcohol and cocaine, and why her oldest son is in an abusive relationship with two men twice his age, and why the courts granted custody of her youngest son to his fireman father. She concluded the source of her problem was twofold, that our mother had sent so much of Daddy's paycheck to Tammy Faye and Jim Baker of TV evangelism fame that we could not afford the Barbie doll Dorinda so craved, and because Mom refused her ballet lessons, since dancing was a sin, Dorinda did the next best thing and became an exotic dancer. Some friends convinced Dorinda to take her story to the talk shows. She sent emails to Maury Povich, Sally Jesse Raphael, and Oprah. Only Rosie O'Donnell bit. Rosie's staff did some digging and discovered that our mother had indeed sent nearly $15,000 to Jim and Tammy Faye. I reminded my sister that we didn't have Barbie, but that we did have Tressie and Barbie's little sister Tammy, and that she and I played dolls endlessly on the splintery hardwood floor of our bedroom in New Albany. That is, until her 13th summer, when a janitor found a famous gospel singer trying to rape her in a mop closet at a concert in Louisville, and Dorinda was shipped off to a Christian drug rehabilitation center for being demon-possessed. 1103 Mountain Time Zone, Christmas Eve, Rock Springs, Wyoming. When I was in the third grade at Edwardsville Elementary School, my class was given a series of black the box with a pencil tests, and each day, as a reward for our endurance, we were given a choice between candy or an ice cream bar. I always chose ice cream. Afterwards, the teachers and principal treated me differently. They nodded, stepped back, whispered between themselves whenever I walked by. Among them was Mrs. Gilbert, my first grade teacher who stood like a model with feet perpendicular and had slick, polished fingernails, and who noted on my report card that I spent my time drawing picture books instead of doing assignments. One day the principal came to my third grade class and escorted me from high-windowed classroom to high-windowed classroom, where he gave me paragraphs to read and large words for me to spell. The difference between principal and principal, I told them, is that the principal is always your pal. It was dark as the Ohio River outside. The horrible wind suddenly muted into a dead calm, and I thought he was trying to prevent us all from thinking about a tornado. Shortly after my spelling performances, Mom begged Daddy to move us to town, but in my new school, I was no longer famous. 5:09 p.m. Riding the bus is much less exciting than I remember. In the past 24 years, I have traveled to Mom and Daddy's maybe 8 or 9 times, mostly by plane, twice on a train, twice by bus, once by car, this time avoiding planes because of money, those times because I was afraid to fly. It had to do with being caught in a tornado over Denver when Brett was 6 weeks old, a fear I overcame when I realized I wasn't afraid of dying. On a flight home in 1997, a man fainted, and the captain asked if there were any medical professionals on board. By that time, I was no longer a nurse or a public health officer, and since no one else spoke, I volunteered to help. The man appeared to be in his mid-20s, pale and clammy. The steward strapped on oxygen, which brought the man around. The young man said he'd been on a 24-hour drinking binge with no food. I gave him sips of water, then orange juice spiked with table sugar, then yogurt. The steward escorted me to the pilot's cabin to report the man's condition. I looked past the handsome uniformed men with silver stars on their shoulders and the red signal blips and fanning lights of the chrome switch control panel to a sky blue as heaven, feeling as vast and alive and insignificant as I felt the first time on the shore of the Pacific, a view from Top Gun. All the knowledge in the human universe, 35,000 feet below my shoes, and none of it as beautiful and as true as this. It occurred to me that flying is a trick. We don't fly. We just believe we do. It's belief in where we are going that keeps us airborne.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be.
Patricia is on the Lostine reading old journals. She relays the story of a bus trip home to see her parents after a long period of separation. An ER doc is standing by in Phoenix, the captain said, to talk you through if the situation becomes emergent. I told him the guy was young, no history of disease. He was dehydrated and hypoglycemic, his symptoms merely exacerbated by the dry, artificial air of the pressurized cabin. Look ahead, the captain said. You are one of the few Americans ever to stand inside the cockpit while in flight. For as far as I could see, it was blue sky, on and on forever, blue sky. My mother has never flown, never ridden a bus, never driven a car. 11:30 p.m. Central Time Zone, Ogallala, Nebraska. Mom, I remember a time when you did ride the bus. You took me to downtown New Albany for shopping and dental appointments. You bought a bag of orange marshmallow circus peanuts to eat beforehand because you said I was having a cavity filled and wouldn't be able to eat candy again until later. It might stick to the filling, you said, and pull it out, and that would really hurt. 9:44 a.m., Christmas Day, Walcott, Iowa. We have a brief layover for breakfast. In the bathroom, I put on a bit of makeup and run water and gel through my hair to try and decrease the haggard look. Now my hair looks dirty and sticky instead of dirty and crumpled. But surely people don't expect much out of a Greyhound passenger. Nothing I can do about my slept-in clothes. There are many mothers and daughters here. Families taking advantage of the Christmas breakfast buffet. Glasses clicking, the smell of bacon, sausage, brewing coffee, round tables full of families. Where the mothers have short hair, so do the daughters. Where the mother is heavy-bosomed, so the daughter. At the table across from me are three generations, old mother, mother-daughter, daughter, all with the same wedged Dorothy Hamill haircut in varying degrees of blonde, all leggy with slender torsos, gold earrings, tiny gold neck chains, dark-rimmed eyeglasses, all wearing sweaters knit with holiday colors and icons, like mother, like daughter, my mother's eyes dancing. 11:02 a.m., crossing into Illinois, the Mississippi River is frozen. A woman walks her young daughter to the rear of the bus for the restroom, then carries her back to their seat, the little girl hanging to her mother, koala fashion. For a while, I wet the bed when we lived in the basement house because I was afraid of my other choices. Go to the outhouse in the dark where a snake once fell off the roof onto Daddy's neck, or go to the chipped porcelain night pot in the laundry room where Mom and Daddy set a trap because she had seen a rat. In the morning, she would swear and beat me with a belt, yelling, "You should be ashamed of yourself, a big girl like you." In the summer of 1996, when I went home for the first time in nearly a decade, Mom told me other stories of beating me and her reasons for it, things like my failing to pick up my toys or walking into the living room naked at the age of two in front of an insurance salesman. "I just beat your ass," my mother, who long ago deposited foul language into the same bank as mortal sin, told me. But I cannot think about the laundry room without thinking about the Ringer washing machine with its Frankenstein construction. A zinc wash tub bolted to four painted metal legs on black rubber wheels, and a mother eating a pair of wooden rollers leading to a wood-handled crank. Understanding that Mom had to carry water by the bucketful and heat it on the propane stove just to wash my soiled underwear, sheets, and pajama bottoms every morning. 12 noon, Chicago, Illinois. Car-lined streets buried under mounds of snow. When I get there, they will tell me how I look. Dad will say, "Who are you?" He will subtly comment later about how he and I should go on a diet. We will spend hours every day driving the countryside, stopping into country cooking restaurants to watch the hands of the clock go by. Mom will up the volume on her Christian music and Christian television at the same time and rarely come out of the bedroom. When she does, she will call me Fatso, Chubby Legs. She will say, "You could have been Miss America, but you didn't even try." I could have lived in Chicago, too, but I didn't even try. But I visited once during the latter part of my nursing career. It was after I'd received my commissioning with the U.S. Public Health Service, a lieutenant, just transferred from the Nez Perce tribe to the Coeur d'Alenes. The first thing the Coeur d'Alenes did was ship me to Chicago to the American School of Management. Mom and Daddy once refused to let me take a bus trip to Chicago when I was in the sixth grade because of the outbreak of riots. The trip was an award from the New Albany School District for academic achievement. 11:32 p.m., Eastern Time Zone, December 26, Ramsey, Indiana. Daddy was waiting for me at the Louisville bus terminal when I arrived last night. That place has changed, too, from the 70s, everything plastic and computerized. I was worried about riding with Daddy, whose red hair, diluted with white, appears pink. But he did okay. No signs of the aphasia I'd expected. No droops or twitches in his face, although his gait is slowed. The homestead, however, is mostly what I expected. From the outside, framed in scrub cedar and hardy maple and 2 weeks of glittery snowfall, if not for the dozen or so dead or dying panel trucks, various sedans, and pickups accumulated around the house, the scene might be one from the glossy box of a jigsaw puzzle or a page in a southern Indiana touring magazine. But inside, it is a glorified double-wide trailer with vinyl wallboards and cotton blend curtains, the tubs and toilet seats already yellowed and cracked. The carpet is dark teal and worn as a Walmart throw rug, faded in spots where the sun hits, threadbare from the two-person flow of traffic in and out the front door. The well is contaminated from snakes, my daddy thinks. Every bath, sink full of dishes, and hand washing demands a squirt of liquid bleach. After 24 hours, my fingers are already raw from it, and my hair feels stiff. And I was wrong. She hasn't called me any of her usual things. She's been almost, well, respectful. 3:33 p.m., December 27th. 6 new inches of snow. More snow on the ground than Indiana has seen in a decade. Mom is wearing 2 baseball caps, 1 bill forward, 1 back. She brought out the green and white Juliet dress I made for myself when I was 14 and a beige wool coat I designed and constructed at 19. Mom is also wearing a short-sleeved yellow pullover sweater and an ornate old rhinestone necklace I remember as a formal thing, an adornment for special occasions, weddings, funerals, Easter. And the night Daddy promised but failed to take her to see Romeo and Juliet at the drive-in. It reminds me of the Manhattan skyline turned bottom-side upwards, as Daddy would say. A few years ago, he gave me a paperback version of the play he'd run across in his flea market travels. That's where my mind is when I realize Mom's orange panties are on over the outside of a pair of white shorts, under a red gingham apron with flowers cross-stitched on the front, something Dorinda made for her in home ec. Mom is standing over a sink of dirty dishes and 5 pounds of apples Dad and I picked up at the store, all in the same crust-filled dishwater with its squirt of bleach, trying, she said, to get this mess cleaned up. Daddy told me a story while we were out having breakfast and shopping for coffee about the old woman who lived next door to them on Schrader Avenue in New Albany, a house they lived in for the 10 years prior to moving here, another haunted place. I think all the places we've lived in have been haunted. The place where my mother suffered a major psychotic break, broke her hip, from where Daddy was carted in an ambulance during his heart attack. He likes to talk about the ghost family of settlers in that house, who he is certain possessed my mother's body, causing her to change personalities. A place where my brother Delbert and I performed an exorcism in 1996 when I finally returned home. I burned sweetgrass and the bark from virgin cedars I'd brought with me. Prior to my leaving the Nez Perce Reservation, Leonard Wahoban instructed me to go to certain places to gather the bark for its protective properties. "You'll need it up north there with the Coeur d'Alenes," he said. When I mentioned this to another tribal member, she told me, "Well, the Coeur d'Alenes are not like the Nez Perce, in it?" I marked the doorways and windows with ashes, slept with medicine bags hanging over my bed and clutched in my fist. Delbert read from the 23rd Psalm and anointed the furniture and doorways with olive oil. He saw 7 chrome balls float up the staircase from the storm cellar under the new bedroom addition. I felt but could not see all but one of those things float out the back door. That night, Dad awoke to see the one who stayed behind standing at the foot of his bed, a little girl in a long, tattered dress and a bonnet hanging down her back from its strings. The next morning, we chased her out, too. The woman next door was nearly deaf and had a strict love for Jesus, although she was a little more intellectual in her religious pursuits, being a staunch Presbyterian like some of the more civilized of my daddy's kin, including the cleric by the name of Morris who came to this country from Scotland in the 1680s, and whose fighting sons branched off to start the Morrison clan. During the worst of Mom's psychosis, the neighbor woman began insisting to her grown children that she was hearing the most beautiful heavenly music. The children talked to Dad because they worried their frail but independent mother and grandmother was having pre-death cognition. Turns out it was Mom's gospel music. She was cranking the volume on her stereo turntable so high her 96-year-old deaf neighbor could hear it. Other neighbors asked Dad about his wife's mind. None of us noticed that Mom has not always been completely normal. She is normal for her. After they moved to the property at Ramsey, Mom called 911 4 times to report that she and her husband were experiencing a financial emergency. 5:02 p.m. There are address labels stuck to everything, planters, cabinets, dishes, lamps. They say, Melba Faye Morrison, 25854 Deer Hollow Road, Ramsey, Indiana, 47168. They look like the kind UNICEF or Amnesty International sends during the holidays. 7:30 p.m. It is my fault my mother is ill. I had been working as director of community health programs for the Coeur d'Alene tribe for 6 months when circumstances forced me to fire Vestal LeBlanc, a nurse's aide supervisor who had worked in tribal programs for many years. I had a staff of 5 nurses and nurse's aides, initially, who called me everything from yellow hair to white buffalo calf woman, and who, during my first days on the reservation, loaded me into a maroon GSA Chevy Corsica to tour the reservation. "We should bury her with nothing but her head out, eh, jokes?" Vestal said. They all laughed, but my heart felt like ground mustard. Dear stomach. The others, an RN named Bonnie, an LPM named Paula, 2 nurse aides, Wilhelmina and Susan, and my administrative assistant, Pamela, seemed to enjoy working with me, and we spent our days spinning the fibers of new programs, chronic disease monitoring, fetal alcohol syndrome awareness, diabetes education, wellness, nutrition, maternal child health, communicable disease, HIV prevention and detection, sexually transmitted disease awareness and prevention, a needle exchange program. From our offices on the 2nd floor of a carpeted, upholstered new medical clinic, everything teal and raspberry and stainless steel. Although the Coeur d'Alenes were not the first tribe to offer care to non-Indian patrons, they were certainly the most successful. I was secretly thrilled by the thought of the white man's power being dead. The Indians had them by their weak spots, making money off their capitalist habits in a glittering new casino north of the clinic by about 15 car minutes. When the lights go out, I wrote in a journal from that time, the Indians will rise to power because they still know how to live off the land. My dissatisfaction with the design of the nursing bag the government issued me at Lapway is what brought this trouble on my family. My issue bag was one deep hole with a single zipper. I wanted compartments, a place for files, a place for blood pressure cuffs and stethoscopes, adult and pediatric, a separate place for education materials, one for latex gloves and syringes, one for my AccuCheck machine and diabetes supplies, one for sterile gauze and tape, one for my pocket-sized assessment and diagnosis books, and an insulated pocket in which I could pop a square of blue ice and insulin, vaccines, TB serum, or a vial of Rocephin in case I had to track down and treat gonorrhea. As it was, I carried a smaller tote and matching clutch to accommodate these things. I thought reducing the number of bags I carried into houses would minimize the chances for cross-contamination. The Coeur d'Alenes ran a sewing factory where they designed and made everything from parachutes for smoke jumpers to backpacks and Pendleton jackets, so I got approval to drive up and get an estimate for a new bag. What no one anticipated is that the side visit I'd make to the new Tohi Medical Center that day would end in a memorandum of agreement between the Coeur d'Alenes and the U.S. Public Health Service, transferring me north to carry out my vision for a tribally run community and public health agency serving both Indians and whites. I eventually hoped to present our case to the Idaho State Legislature to capture for the Coeur d'Alenes their share of state public health dollars. We didn't make it that far in the 18 months I held the position, but we did expand so far as to provide for a nurse for local public schools and environmental health for the reservation. We even had a Medicaid officer housed in community health offices, an ice-eyed woman who, after I expressed anxiety over my decision to resign my commission and become a writer, told me, "Remember when Indiana Jones has to walk across the invisible bridge to reach the Holy Grail? Well, that is you. Beneath you is a bridge you cannot see." Firing Vestal was even scarier than taking Zach to live with Mark. She was 50 years old, Indian in the old way, alternating Salish with English. She draped her throat with beadwork, loaded puffed hands with turquoise and silver. She was sometimes charming, sometimes aloof, sometimes alluring, her smile distinguished by a gold cap, sometimes snarling, that gold cap becoming the eye tooth of a cougar. It was during this time that I had dreams of my naked body muscled and powerful beneath the head of a gray wolf, my opponents topped by the head of a cougar. In the end, the wolf woman always shedding the mortal blood of the cougar woman.
You've been listening to Paula Coomer, reading from her novel, Dove Creek.
All the oxen free, come out from behind the tree. You and I were meant to be naked and ashamed.
Dress your soul, mama.
You were always beautiful to me.
Dress your soul.
You were always beautiful to me.
Dress your soul, mama. Oh.
Dove Creek was produced by Nancy Casey and Paula Coomer with help from KRFP, a listener-supported non-commercial radio station at 92.5 FM in Moscow, Idaho. You can find KRFP on the web at krfp.org, where you can click on Dove Creek to learn more about this broadcast, sign up for a podcast, or send an email. There you can also contact Bill Finch, who wrote and performs our theme song.